TED Talks are recorded live at the TED Conference and partner events. This episode features curator Luke Sison. This talk contains powerful visuals. Download the video at TED.com. Here's Luke Sison.
2 years ago, I have to say, there was no problem. 2 years ago, I knew exactly what an icon looked like. It looks like this. Everybody's icon, but also the default position of a curator of Italian Renaissance paintings, which I was then. And in a way, this is also another default selection. Leonardo da Vinci's exquisitely soulful image of the lady with an ermine. And I use that word soulful deliberately. Or then there's this, or rather these, the two versions of Leonardo's Virgin of the Rocks that were about to come together in London for the very first time. In the exhibition that I was then in the absolute throes of organizing, I was literally up to my eyes in Leonardo, and I had been for 3 years. So this was he was occupying every part of my brain. And Leonardo had taught me during that 3 years about what a picture can do, about taking you from your own material world into a spiritual world. He said, actually, that he believed the job of the painter was to paint everything that was visible and invisible in the universe. It's a huge task, and yet somehow he achieves it. He shows us, I think, the human soul. He shows us the capacity of ourselves to move into a spiritual realm, to see a vision of the universe that's more perfect than our own, to see God's own plan in some sense. So this, in a sense, was really what I believed an icon was. At about that time, I started talking to Tom Campbell, director here of the Metropolitan Museum, about what my next move might be. The move, in fact, back to an earlier life, one I'd begun at the British Museum, back to the world of three dimensions, of sculpture and of decorative arts, to take over the Department of European Sculpture and Decorative Arts here at the Met. But it was an incredibly busy time, and all the conversations were done at very peculiar times of the day, over the phone, and in the end, I accepted the job without actually having been here again from, I'd been there a couple of years before, but on that particular visit. So it was just before the time that the Leonardo show was due to open when I finally made it back to the Met, to New York, to see my new domain, to see what European sculpture and decorative arts looked like beyond those Renaissance collections with which I was so already familiar. And I thought, on that very first day, I'd better tour the galleries. 57 of these galleries, like 57 varieties of baked beans, I believe. And I walked through, and I started in my comfort zone in the Italian Renaissance. And then I moved gradually round, feeling a little lost sometimes, but my head also still full of the Leonardo exhibition that was about to open, and I came across this. And I thought to myself, what the hell have I done? There was absolutely no connection in my mind at all. And in fact, if there was any emotion going on, it was a kind of repulsion. This object felt utterly and completely alien, silly at a level that I hadn't yet understood silliness to be. And then it was made worse. There are two of them. So I started thinking about why it was, in fact, that I'd dislike this object so much. What was the anatomy of my distaste? Well, so much gold, so vulgar, so nouveau riche, frankly. And Leonardo himself had preached against the use of gold. So it was absolutely anathema at that moment. And then those little pretty sprigs of flowers everywhere. And finally, that pink. That damned pink. It's such an extraordinarily artificial color. I mean, it's a color that I can't think of anything that you actually see in nature that looks that shade. The object even has its own tutu. This little flouncy, spangly, bottomy bit that sits at the bottom of the vase. And it reminded me in an odd kind of way of my niece's fifth birthday party where all the little girls had come either as a princess or a fairy. There was one who'd come as a fairy princess. You should have seen the looks. And I realized that this object was in my mind, born from the same mind, from the same womb, practically, as Barbie Ballerina. And then there's the elephants. Those extraordinary elephants with their little sort of strange, sinister expressions and Greta Garbo eyelashes with these golden tusks and so on. And I realized this was an elephant that had absolutely nothing to do with a majestic march across the Serengeti. It was a Dumbo nightmare. But something more profound was happening as well. These objects, it seemed to me, were quintessentially the kind that I and my liberal left friends in London had always seen as summing up something deplorable about the French aristocracy in the 18th century. The label had told me that these pieces were made by the Sèvres manufactory, made of porcelain in the late 1750s, and designed by a designer called Jean-Claude Duplessis, actually somebody of extraordinary distinction, as I later learned. But for me, it was that they summed up a kind of the sort of sheer uselessness of the aristocracy in the 18th century. And you know, I and my colleagues had always thought, you know, that these objects, in a way, summed up the idea of, you know, no wonder there was a revolution, or indeed, thank God there was a revolution. And there was a sort of idea, really, that if you owned a vase like this, then, you know, there was really only one fate possible. So there I was in a sort of paroxysm of horror. But I took the job, I went on looking at these vases. I sort of had to, because they're on a through route in the Met. So almost anywhere I went, there they were. And they had a kind of odd sort of fascination, like, you know, like a car accident, where I couldn't stop looking. And as I did so, I started thinking, well, you know, what are we actually looking at here? And what I started with was understanding this as really a supreme piece of design. It took me a little time, but that tutu, for example, actually, this is a piece that does dance in its own way. It has an extraordinary lightness, and yet it's also amazingly balanced. It has this kind of sculptural ingredients, and then the play between actually really quite carefully disposed color and gilding and the sculptural surface is really rather remarkable. And then I realized that this piece went into the kiln four times, at least four times, in order to arrive at this. How many moments for accident can you think of that could have happened to this piece? And then remember, not just one, but two. So he's having to arrive at two exactly matched vases of this kind. And then this question of uselessness. Well, actually, the end of the trunks were originally candle holders. And so what you would have had were candles on either side. And imagine that effect of candlelight on that surface, on this slightly uneven pink, on the beautiful gold. It would have glittered in an interior, a little like a little firework. And at that point, actually, a firework went off in my brain. Somebody reminded me that word fancy, which in a sense, for me, encapsulated this object, actually comes from the same root as the word fantasy. And that what this object was, just as much in a way, in its own way, as a Leonardo da Vinci painting, is a portal to somewhere else. This is an object of the imagination. And if you think about, you know, the mad 18th century operas of the time, that set in the Orient, if you think about divans and perhaps even opium-induced visions of pink elephants, then at that point this object starts to make sense. This is an object which is all about escapism. It's about an escapism that happens, that the aristocracy in France sought very deliberately to distinguish themselves from ordinary people. It's not an escapism that we feel particularly happy with today, however. And again, going on thinking about this, I realized that in a way we're all victims of a certain kind of tyranny of the triumph of modernism, whereby form and function in an object have to follow one another or deemed to do so, and that extraneous ornament is seen as really essentially criminal. It's a triumph in a way of bourgeois values rather than aristocratic ones, and that seems fine. except for the fact that it becomes a kind of sequestration of imagination. And so just as in the 20th century, so many people had the idea that their faith took place on the Sabbath day, and the rest of their lives, their lives of, you know, washing machines and orthodontics took place on another day, then we, I think, have started doing the same. We've allowed ourselves to lead our fantasy lives in front of screens, in the dark of the cinema, with a television in the corner of the room. And we've eliminated, in a sense, that constant of the imagination that these vases represented in people's lives. So maybe it's time we got this back a little. I think it's beginning to happen. In London, for example, with these extraordinary buildings that have been appearing over the last few years, redolent, in a sense, of science fiction, turning London into a kind of fantasy playground. It's actually amazing to look out of a high building nowadays there. But even then, there's a resistance. Londoners call these buildings the gherkin, the shard, the walkie-talkie, bringing these soaring buildings down to earth. There's an idea that we don't want this anxious-making, imaginative journeys to happen in our daily lives. I feel lucky in a way. I've encountered this object. I found him on the internet when I was looking up a reference, and there he was. And unlike the pink elephant vase, this was a kind of love at first sight. In fact, reader, I married him. I bought him, and he now adorns my office. He's a Staffordshire figure, made in the middle of the 19th century. He represents the actor Edmund Kean playing Shakespeare's Richard III. And it's based, actually, on a more elevated piece of porcelain. So I loved, on an art historical level, I loved that layered quality that he has. But more than that, I love him. In a way that I think would have been impossible without the pink Sèvres vase in my Leonardo days, I love his orange and his pink breeches. I love the fact that he seems to be going off to war, having just finished the washing up. And he seems also to have forgotten his sword. I love his pink little cheeks, this munchkin energy. And in a way, he's become my sort of alter ego. He's, I hope, a little bit dignified, but mostly rather vulgar. And unenergetic, I hope, too. I let him into my life because the Sèvres pink elephant vase allowed me to do so. And before that, Leonardo, I understood that this object could become part of a journey for me every day, sitting in my office. And I really hope that others, all of you, visiting objects in the museum and taking them home and finding them for yourselves will allow those objects to flourish in your imaginative lives. Thank you very much.
That was Luke Sison, recorded at TEDx Met in New York, New York, October 2013. For more information on TED, visit TED.com.